From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
Our first guest this morning is acclaimed science writer Ferris Jaber, talking about his new book, Becoming Earth, How Our Planet Came to Life. In it, Jaber reveals a radical new vision of Earth where lush forests emit dust, pollen and bacteria to summon rain, giant animals engineer the very landscapes they roam, microbes chew rock to shape continents, and microscopic plankton remake the air and the sea.
And then, in the second part of the show, we'll be speaking with Miranda Massey, who is the founder and director of the Climate Museum, which is located in New York City. The museum is the first of its kind, focusing on the arts and cultural programming to educate the public about the changing climate and compel them to action to reduce their carbon footprint and resource consumption.
Environmental awareness and education, that's what this Green Earth is all about. Joining us on the line is Ferris Jaber. He's a science writer and author of his most recent book, Becoming Earth, How Our Planet Came Alive. Ferris, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the book is really fascinating and pretty weighty in its subject and topic. But before we get to it, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a science writer.
Well, I've been writing about nature and science for the general public for close to 15 years now. I've loved both nature and science and reading and writing from a very young age, kind of thought I would maybe become a research scientist and write on the side, but ended up deciding I did not want to stay in academia and kind of stumbled into the world of people who write about or talk about science by interning with the PBS show Nova and doing a few other related internships. And it seemed to me like that was a really good, you know, combination of my hybrid interests. So I decided to pursue that.
All right. And the book, Becoming Earth, How Our Planet Came Alive. I'm going to read a sentence from kind of the description about the book, and maybe we can start there. It says, Earth is not simply an inanimate planet on which life evolved, but rather a planet that came to life. So let's start there, Ferris. Explain to us the difference between those two things.
Right. So what I would argue is kind of the historical, mainstream, typical way of thinking about Earth is that it's this giant rock in space that happened to be in the right place in the solar system for life to emerge on its surface. And now there's all this living stuff, you know, kind of crawling around the surface of this rock. But the new way of thinking about it is that life is not simply something which inhabits or resides on the planet. It's actually a literal extension of the planet. It's an outgrowth of Earth. So life and Earth are really materially, literally continuous with each other. They are the same. And all living organisms are continually transforming the planet in really profound ways, and they are pulling the entire planet into their own evolution. And so what ends up happening is that life plus the planet becomes a single, highly interconnected, self-regulating living system. So, you know, Earth is a planet that literally came to life. Life is something that happened to the planet as a whole. It's not just a superficial surface phenomenon.
When do you think that Earth kind of came to life? Can we point back to a time where we first saw that occurring?
The current consensus in science is that, you know, the planet stirred to life somewhere between 3 to 4 billion years ago.
Okay, and by doing so in its most simplest sense, with single cell organisms and the like.
Right. And so the way I think about it is that, if we go back more than 4 billion years, Earth was this giant water world with a vast ocean, but probably not any substantial continents. It had a very different atmosphere. It had a hazy orange atmosphere with essentially no oxygen. And life had to emerge from the inanimate, material, substrate of the planet. So that process, the process of the origin of life, was literally bits and pieces of the planet, bits and pieces of Earth, rearranging themselves into the first self-replicating entities and then the first single cells. And so really, that is how life is truly emerging from Earth, just as a sand castle is made of the beach, from which it emerges. Life is in the same way made of Earth. So that's, the old way of thinking is that, life happened on Earth, but I now think of it as Earth coming to life. So bits and pieces of the planet are becoming the first organisms.
And those first organisms then begin to, like you say, reshape the atmosphere, the chemistry of the atmosphere, which then creates, I guess, a treadmill effect of which then provides more opportunity for additional organisms, and off we go from there.
Exactly. And, microbes, I think, deserve the bulk of the credit for really transforming the planet in the most profound ways. For more than 2 billion years, there was nothing but single-celled microbial life on our planet. So they are really the most ancient, the most numerous, the most pervasive form of life on our planet. And they completely changed everything. They revolutionized the chemistry and the structure of our planet. They created the breathable atmosphere. They shifted the sky from orange to blue. They made fire possible for the first time. They're responsible for the mineral diversity of our planet. They maybe even helped construct the continents. So everything that we inherited, like by the time our species emerged, hundreds of thousands of years ago, we inherited a world that had been made and remade by microbes and plants and animals and fungi over billions of years.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that generally we as humans, I hope, in more informed ways evolve, but it seems we almost maybe devolved in the idea of a living planet, and we're making it more of an object than really something that we are a part of. It's something that we maybe take advantage of or use its resources, but we're not so much with this idea that we are of this living planet together, as you had said. And I think maybe historically we had more thoughts of us being a part of it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think if we look, into really ancient history, we see this idea of a living world being very common. We find this in cultures and mythologies, and in indigenous wisdom going really far back in time. But then, with the advent of Western science, empirical science, reductionism, by the time you get to the time of Charles Darwin, this idea of the planet being alive and us being part of a larger living entity was no longer popular. Now it was all about segregating the living from the non-living and, categorizing things as specifically as possible. And I think Western science has been in a long process of kind of returning to or corroborating certain forms of ancient insights, and sort of grappling with this concept that life can happen at more than just the scale of the organism, that something like an ecosystem or a planet can be alive too.
And yeah, and humans as a species are most changing the world. We're the ones that are changing this planet the most. So how do we bring our mindset back to not being the only species that truly maybe matters on this world?
Right. So we are the most extreme example, the most current example of life transforming the planet. And no other species before us has changed so many different parts of the planet so quickly. I mean, basically every part that we've touched, and even in parts that we haven't, we have transformed, the atmosphere, the oceans, the continents. We use more than half of the planet's habitable land to grow crops and raise livestock. We've overfished the oceans and polluted it with plastic, and we've pumped a huge amount of carbon into the atmosphere. perhaps this much carbon has never entered the atmosphere this quickly in any other point in Earth's 4.54 billion year history. But we are not the only species that has changed the planet. So, you know, we are just the latest chapter in a long line of life remaking Earth. And what's special about us is that we are so self-aware that we have the unique ability to sort of step back and analyze the system as a whole and recognize in the moment how we are changing the system as a whole. Whereas most species are restricted to much, you know, slower, more gradual evolutionary change, and they're not consciously participating in the changes that they are making. But we have the choice. You know, we can step back and say, this is what we're doing. This is how it's harming the greater Earth system, this larger living entity we're a part of. And this is how we can change things for the better if we so choose.
So the book is kind of broken down into three general sections, rock, water, and air. And keeping with this theme here that humans are impacting or putting stress on all three of those components, Ferris, which one of those do you see as putting the most stress on and the one that, I don't know, maybe concerns you the most?
Well, I think the central concern right now, you know, in the current planetary crisis is how our species has massively perturbed the planet's long-term carbon cycle. Mm-hmm. And we have primarily done this by pouring a huge amount of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. You know, and the major sources of those are burning fossil fuels for energy and then industrial agriculture and related food systems. And what this has done is to thicken the atmosphere's heat-trapping cloak of greenhouse gases. So you always need some amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to keep the planet warm and habitable. But too much can push the planet into an extreme hothouse state, mm-hmm. and it will become much more tempestuous, unpredictable, inhospitable. It will become the kind of world that simply cannot support our way of life as it currently is. And that is what we are doing to the planet right now. That is the change that we are bringing to the Earth system as a whole. And that, I think, you know, has to be the central concern and the central challenge for us is how do we reform our way of life, our relationship with the planet, so that we are not pushing it into this dangerously unstable state that will not support us.
And some say that, you know, we're in the sixth mass extinction. So the planet has gone through a series of extinctions, and I guess we could define that biologically or so, but the planet has been able to recover in one form or another. Is that a form of self-regulation or kind of resetting, the planet being able to reset its conditions?
Earth does have this incredible innate resilience. So Earth has gone through five great extinctions, mass extinctions, which means that the majority of species alive at the time go extinct. Mm-hmm. And basically the biodiversity of the planet recedes to just a fraction of what it was before. But every time that has happened, not only has our planet recovered, but it has then flourished. Mm. And arguably it is the most complex and biodiverse today that it has ever been. So there is this incredible overlapping elaborate systems of self-regulation and restabilizing. However, they take an extremely long time to have an effect, you know, so the Earth can recover over tens of thousands to millions of years. And in the process, it becomes wildly unstable and many, many species go extinct. And it takes a very long time to reach that new stabilization period. It's sort of like how when we get really, really sick, we might develop, you know, a high fever and body shakes and just be bedridden for a long time before we eventually recover, you know, and get back to that restabilized state. And the problem is that we can't just rely on these innate self regulating or restabilizing processes, because they would take so long that we would not survive the journey. We would not come out on the other side. So that's why we have to intervene ourselves and do so rapidly.
And what are some examples of human trying to be more, I guess, pro-balance for our planet?
Well, one of the chapters in my book is all about the role of fire in the Earth system and the ecology of fire. And it focuses on the story of an indigenous fire ecologist named Frank Lake, who works in Northern California. And he believes that, a really powerful way to approach all of these problems is to combine indigenous traditional ecological knowledge with modern Western science and use the best of both. So he's been at the forefront of returning indigenous practices of controlled burns or prescribed burns to the Western landscape to mitigate the risk of extremely intense wildfires, like the kind we've seen in the last few decades. So his work has been really important in getting state and federal agencies to be more accepting of these traditional practices to mitigate the risk of extreme wildfires. And I think his story is a really powerful example of how we can learn to work with ecosystems in which we are embedded, as opposed to constantly trying to harness them or control them just for our own benefit. And indigenous peoples have been using fire in this way for thousands of years before it was suppressed when colonists came over.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Ferris Jaber. He's a science writer and the author of the new book, Becoming Earth: How Our Planet Came Alive. Well, sticking with fire, let's talk about the biggest fire of all, and that's the sun. Could we include the sun as part of the Earth's, I don't know, successful form of living?
I think so. I mean, the sun is so crucial. It's really where everything begins because you have to have a major energy source. The sun is the engine, the furnace that powers Earth's life. And it really all begins with photosynthetic life, making the most dramatic transformations. So when life learned to channel the sun's energy and to combine that with widely available resources like water and carbon dioxide, that's when Earth's life really got going and things really began to change. So the sun as kind of the solar furnace of Earth's life is definitely a hugely crucial component.
Yeah, although over the decades, we're beginning to observe that there are species on the planet, organisms or so, that can survive in the absence of sun, like some bacteria that are found deep within the Earth's crust or vents deep down, say in marine vents, tens of thousands of feet down. So there are organisms on the planet that can do, more or less without the sun, or maybe there's still an interconnectedness there.
Yeah, we used to think, even just a few decades ago, we used to think that there was basically no life
Yeah.
Anywhere below a few meters,
Right.
below the planet's surface, because it was simply too dark and hot and inhospitable for anything. And we now know that actually the planet's rocky interior is perfused with all of these cracks and fissures that are full of water. And some scientists think there's actually more water trapped in the Earth's crust than exists on the surface. So that's an immense volume of warm water. And we now know that microbes live all throughout the planet's crust. At least 2 miles down, maybe even deeper. And because they don't have access to sunlight or oxygen typically, they have had to evolve different ways of getting energy and sustaining themselves. So some of these microbes can literally eat or breathe rock. So they'll take rock or metals or minerals into their bodies from the environment and use them in some biologically useful way and then put out new forms of them into their environment. So they're constantly changing the mineralogy of the planet as they make their living down there. And this is also happening on the sea floor, beneath the sea floor, beneath ice at the poles. Pretty much everywhere we've kind of peeled back the Earth's layers and looked, we find these extremophile microbes. Finding a way to survive. And indeed, in the very, very beginning, in the earliest chapters of our planet, the main sources of energy was sunlight, but also geothermal heat, the planet's own internal heat, because the planet's been cooling down for a very long time, and it still has a very hot center. So it's still radiating a lot of heat from within. And some microbes use that energy coming from within as well. So that those are really the most ancient forms of energy that any kind of life could rely on.
And as we look at the natural world, obviously, mostly we are in awe of evolution and how animals, and I've heard you describe it as this, have an agency over their own evolution. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, the typical way of thinking about it is that life is always responding to its environment, that when the earth goes through changes, when the environment changes, organisms have to keep up and adapt to that changing environment. And that is absolutely true. But at the same time, life is constantly changing its environment, and it's often changing its environment in ways that is beneficial to itself and to its continued existence. So it's really a reciprocal process. It's, you know, scientists now think of it as co-evolution of life and environment. The two are constantly changing each other. And so life is folding in its environment, wrapping in its environment to its own evolution and survival. And over really long periods of time, you get these incredible ecological relationships and rhythms evolving that kind of ensure the mutual persistence of both life and environment. For example, one of the most powerful examples that really astonished me is that the Amazon rainforest is not just receiving the rain on which it depends, it's actually generating that rain. The Amazon is creating about half of the rain that falls on its canopy each year. And so, you know, it's pulling huge volumes of water from the soil, releasing what it doesn't use to the atmosphere. And at the same time, it's spewing these invisible plumes of tiny biological particles into the sky, things like pollen grains and microbes and fungal spores. And all of that suspended water then condenses onto those particles. And that is exactly what forms clouds. Mm.
Yeah,
scientists have described the Amazon as, you know, this massive cloud factory. You know, it's dramatically accelerating the water cycle.
And I can't help but think about now all of the microplastics that are become ubiquitous to our world and our atmosphere. And perhaps maybe even those will start to show up in the Amazon. But yeah, rain may form around microplastics, which is ironic because what is plastic? But in a way, oil, which comes from phytoplankton, biological sources. So there's an odd interconnectedness there. But that's another way of how we're slowly influencing changes to the planet, too.
Yeah, microplastics are particularly pervasive in the Earth system. I mean, we found them pretty much everywhere. You know, the atmosphere, the deep ocean, the coasts, the crust, and even within our own bodies, you know, in our own lungs and blood, we find them there as well. And they're so new as a material, as a substance, that we really don't understand everything about them and what happens to them when they get into both ecological and biological systems.
Another couple minutes. Tell us the story about your backyard and how you became the creator of worlds, in a sense, your backyard.
So about 4 years ago, my partner and I bought a house here in Portland, Oregon, and there was nothing but a derelict grass lawn in the backyard. So we ripped that all out with the intention of creating a beautiful garden from scratch. But we quickly discovered that our soil was in really bad shape. You know, it was full of clay and debris and rubble, and it had previously been a parking lot and a construction site for a long time. So it was very abused and neglected. And I even confirmed through laboratory soil tests that it was depleted of nutrients like nitrogen, which is so important for plants. So I had to rapidly learn about soil science and what to do about this situation, how to revitalize this landscape. And what I discovered is that it really starts with plants. You know, when you bring a large array of diverse, healthy plants to an emaciated landscape, they do many important things. They break apart the soil with their roots. They bring in their symbiotic partners like fungi and microbes. And then they protect the soil and its unique architecture with a cloak of vegetation. And so, you know, over the past few years, by adding more and more plants, we've seen our soil ecosystem come back to life, and we've seen the soil become much more supple and more workable. And I realized that my whole life, I'd really been thinking about soil incorrectly, because I'd always thought of it as basically a fabric that you can condition, or a kind of repository of nutrients that you can deplete and replenish. But there's growing recognition in science that soil is not just a substrate or a medium for life, but is itself alive. You know, soil is a dynamic living network made of rock, water, air, and creature. And it's really the relationships between them that create and maintain soil as we understand it. And for most of Earth's history, it did not have soil as we know it. It just had crumbled rock. It took the advent of complex life and hundreds of millions of years of interaction with that rock to create the organic, rich, fertile soils that we now depend on to grow crops. So soil, you know, is a recent development in our planet's history. It is itself a living system, and it's very precious in that sense because it can be destroyed so easily.
Ferris, I am sad to say we are coming close to the end of this segment. We could talk to you for hours. You are obviously a wealth of knowledge, and I truly hope that we can have you back on the show to share more about your writings and about even this book. I'm sure we've just scratched a tiny bit of the surface around this. But if people want to get your book or learn more about you and your writing, where can they go?
They can visit my website, which is just my name, ferrisjabr.com. And the book should be available pretty much anywhere you want to shop, you know, online or in your favorite local independent bookstore. So yeah, you should be able to get it just about anywhere.
All right. Well, again, the name of the book is Becoming Earth, How Our Planet Came Alive. The author is Ferris Jabr. Ferris, thank you so much again for joining us on This Green Earth.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
And joining us now is Miranda Massey, who is the founder and director of the Climate Museum. Miranda, thank you so much for coming on This Green Earth.
Delighted to be here with you.
Now, first, we like to get a little bit of a background on our guests, and we want to talk about your path and then the catalyst to you creating this Climate Museum.
My first career was as a social justice courtroom lawyer, a social justice impact litigator. And I worked mostly on issues of racial equality in education in the workplace, though on other progressive social concerns as well. And at a certain point in that trajectory, I realized that while I had been directing my attention to the workplace and to schooling as the main places in which structural inequities express themselves in our society, in fact, environmental injustice is, in a sense, the first and most primary way in which inequality in our society gets expressed. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have an equal right to thrive as a living organism, then your other rights are at best harder to enforce and at worst fall away in importance entirely. And so I pivoted to environmental justice and started doing work as an environmental justice advocate and attorney in a activist nonprofit that does different kinds of civil rights legal work. And then at a certain point in that phase of my legal career, the climate crisis began to creep into my consciousness as something that needed my attention, but I felt hesitation about addressing it, partly because I had already made a pretty big pivot and partly because the climate crisis is enormous. And when almost anybody first gets into touch with it and becomes aware of it, there is a lag between when that insight happens and when they feel like they're ready to take action on the basis of that insight. For me, that was a pretty long lag, and I want to encourage anybody out there who has had the recognition and is starting to feel bad about not having acted on it, that you'll almost certainly won't last as long as I did, and it is not too late at any point, and there's no shame in having that lag. Mm-hmm. But I realized at a moment following Hurricane Sandy, sitting in my apartment without electricity, absolutely safe, I want to emphasize, mm-hmm. but I just recognized I can't not do this anymore. I have to direct my attention to climate change. And very shortly after that, the idea for a museum that would be dedicated to bringing the general public on board with civic engagement on the climate crisis was the thing that was missing from what I saw around me. There were scientists advancing that work. Artists were starting to make great art. There were environmental engineers like Chris doing the work that we need for both mitigation and adaptation in relation to climate crisis. Right. But there weren't projects that were, there was vanguard activism that was doing a very good job of raising the profile of the issue and moving things forward in that sense. Policy experts, just a whole gamut of efforts that made a lot of sense to me. But what I didn't see was anything that was directed toward the general public's recognition of the civic agency and power that each of us has, the circles of trust and influence that each of us has that can be brought to bear to shift our general public culture so that the policy we need on climate change becomes imaginable.
So it's interesting to me that you're going down this path and you have this thought of what's missing, how can I fill these missing pieces? And you decided that melding art and educating people on the climate was a good way to communicate and engage people on what we're facing in the climate crisis. What was it about thinking about art installations or the way that they communicate with people resonated with you?
It was really clear to me, and it's still really clear to me, that most people don't respond at the level we want them to purely technical and scientific information about the about what's happening with climate change. We can't take all of that in. It doesn't have emotional impact, and it also can leave us feeling isolated and disempowered. Whereas the arts draw people in inherently. They inherently connect us. We have a genetic mutation that differentiates us from Neanderthals that accounts for aesthetic appreciation. So there's a very real sense in which aesthetic appreciation is built into what humanity is and how people relate to each other. And we all know this intuitively. If you walk into a big empty room that has art on the walls, that's a completely different thing from walking into a big empty room that doesn't have art on the walls. It automatically and at a very profound level touches our emotions and brings us into a sense of being in community with others. And that sense of connection with other people is what we most need to move forward in advancing climate progress.
So you create this climate museum, and share with us about the exhibits. Is it a brick and mortar? Is it a traveling exhibit? How does the climate museum work?
We've done, to this point, pop-up exhibitions and public art installations in different locations. And our next phase of development, which we're embarking on now, is to scale up to a year-round location. Because we've just robustly shown that this idea about how the arts can work to help people recognize their own civic agency and their own power to change things when it comes to climate, we've now robustly seen that in our own experience. And researchers at George Mason University did a before and after study of our last exhibition that confirmed the transformational power of this approach of bringing the arts together with learning opportunities and calls to action. So we know that it works, and we're ready to have a year-round location.
And so what do these exhibits look like? Share with us some of the ideas that you put forth.
You know, they've really run the gamut. We've had a sculpture piece in a public park that also involved a public performance over the course of the day. We had a film that featured ice cores from the Greenland ice sheet. We're very interested in interdisciplinary work that brings the arts into dialogue with climate science, and a number of other projects that have different across different media and with different kinds of aesthetics. The main thing that we focus on is always having arts that have a strong aesthetic impact, and and also arts projects where we can build civic engagement opportunities around them without it feeling too clunky or disjunctive, so that the experience feels unified. And I'll use a specific example from our last exhibition, which was about the history of the fossil fuel industry and had a bunch of specific learning points associated with that, including the history of the climate justice movement's opposition to the fossil fuel industry. But it was all grounded in a 40-foot long mural that was extremely narrative, that told the story of the struggle for and transition to a just and safe future for all. That transitioned also from being monochrome, it was grayscale on the left side and full technicolor on the right. And it went through distinct phases and told a story, and it was visible from any point in the exhibition and framed visitors' experience of the show, framed the specific information that we were giving them in different panels and spaces within the show, including the call to action that framed the final minutes of a visitor's experience there. But without that mural, the show would simply not have functioned in the same way. And we've learned over time that you really need all three ingredients. You need the arts to be the primary focus point that brings people together and causes them to feel connected to each other. You also need to give people new learning opportunities so that they feel confident talking about climate. And then you need to structure specific suggestions for how we can take effective action. Mm-hmm. And that helps people form their own. They can either take our suggestions or they can express their own ideas and make commitments and express those in a visual way by writing them down and putting them up on the wall. And that's a very transformational experience for our core audience, which is the very large percentage of U.S. adults, not large, and it's not majoritarian, but it's a lot of people who are really worried about climate change, haven't yet taken action on it, and who express explicitly that they would like to take action on it. They just don't know what to do. That's fully 11% of the adult population of the U.S. that has those three things. They're alarmed, they're willing, and they're inactive. And you can see why that's the big delta for us. But then, of course, right. There are other audiences that surround that audience, too. Right. But for those people, coming to a show that's constructed like this is a deeply transformative experience.
Right. Where is the museum located? And is it possible that the museum can serve as a template for other towns or communities, large or small, to maybe develop their own climate museum?
That is our dearest hope, Chris.
Yeah.
And we're located in New York City, and the bulk of the work that we've done has been in and around New York City. But we are also currently talking to partners in Barcelona and in Vancouver, and looking at other partnerships as well. We think it's critically important for every city to have at least one climate-dedicated museum. Mm-hmm. We're the first one in the U.S., there are now more and more around the world. We were the second one in the world when we started, but that's the population, I'm happy to say, has now grown. And we absolutely, one of our ambitions for having a year-round space is to be able to use it as a lab for developing exhibition materials that could travel to other places, hopefully other climate museums, but also other community spaces, university spaces, business spaces. It's really important to us to develop work that can be useful to people outside of this organization specifically.
And when you see people walk through this or take this in, what are some of the reactions that you're getting? What are people saying?
It's so inspiring. I left a successful career to do this, so I've always been bullish on this concept. It is much more than confirmed by the way that people react when they come through our shows. There was one person we didn't know who came to our show. We'll never know how he heard about it. And he posted a Google review that said, spend 30 minutes here and it will change your life. And we were all just delighted, of course. And also so, it's so helpful when you put the kind of time and energy into a brand new project that we've been putting into this one, to get that kind of confirmation is just reassuring and inspiring in equal measure. My favorite story, I think, of a visitor transformation was a woman who came to our last show, and she was right in the middle of our sweet spot demographic of people who are worried, haven't done anything out of dread, a false sense of complicity, a sense of isolation, overwhelmed, being outscaled, and want to engage. And when she came in, she expressed to our colleagues who were working the floor that she had been dreading coming to the show, that she knew she had to, but she'd been dreading it. And she expressed concern for them, which was extremely sweet, among other things. How do you deal with being exposed to this information all the time and having to think about this horrible crisis all the time? And they said, look, go through the show and we're really interested to hear what you think of it on the other side. And so she went through the show, and sure enough, she came back to them and she said, I totally get it. I'm so happy for you guys that you get to work here. And I am really excited to tackle the action commitments that I made. So she came in feeling anxiety and dread, and out of a sense of kind of self-hair-shirting duty, like I have to do this because I'm a good person and I care about the climate, but boy, is it going to bum me out. And she left feeling like, not a sense of naive hope. Look, what we face is really, really dramatically anxiety provoking and concerning, no doubt, but with a sense of resolve and of connection to other people who also have that same sense of upbeat determination to move the ball forward in ways that will have ripple effects. And that's how a lot of people respond to the show. And that's the exact reaction that we it's our aspiration to engender.
Right. I find that's really interesting, that people who are fearful, or like you say, anxiety is the best word, over the climate, and therefore want to avoid it, avoid conversation or avoid exposure to it, have their minds changed after visiting the museum. I'll go one step further, knowing how polarizing the conversations can be around climate and climate change and the science of it. Have people who are downright skeptics come in and maybe had their minds changed or suggested that they're more open to learning more about the impacts of climate change?
We haven't had that many skeptics come through.
Yeah.
And that is something that I would hope would change over time as we grow. But I will say that the ones who've come through have engaged in good faith conversation with the people on the floor and have expressed some degree, it varies from case to case, of opening up around the different issues involved. It is, I think, for us, what's most important is everybody is welcome, of course. But what's most important is to create ripple effects that can compound each other, so that we see, and this is beyond the work of any one institution, particularly a pretty new and small one, but over time, we want to see a shift in the general culture that can support the policy we need. Because that the policies that we have that maintain the fossil fuel economy and culture are so deeply embedded in our history that we really need a cultural shift to move away from that. And what we're most focused on are the visitors who are most likely to have a big delta between the before and after of coming to the museum. So we are absolutely interested in changing everybody's mind into an active civic engagement posture.
Right.
And we've seen some signs that this work can be effective with skeptics too. And there's actually there's a peer-reviewed piece on how art reduces polarization with respect to climate information specifically. That's quite interesting that I can send you guys.
Yeah.
So it's the arts have have magical powers in this area that are currently, I think, underestimated by both policymakers and frankly funders. They really have the ability to move things forward. And it's also true that museums are really popular and really trusted as social institutions at a time when social trust is not thriving in our country, unfortunately.
Right.
And museums are a place where we can rebuild that and rebuild it in a way that helps us advance on this big challenge.
Well, we are interested to keep following your progress with this and to see where those exhibits pop up next. And if someone were to want to get involved or to take a greater look at what you're doing, where would they go to do that?
Thank you so much for asking that. Climatemuseum.org. And there you can sign up for our newsletter. You can reach out to contact us if you'd like to get involved. And the website also has a lot of information about specific exhibitions that we haven't had time to detail here, but it allows you to do a nice deep dive on the work that we've done to date and where we're hoping to go.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Miranda Massey, founder and director of the Climate Museum. If you want to learn more, you can go to climatemuseum.org. And what a great way to bring people together through the arts and a greater understanding of, like you said, what we're facing, but to put that lens, a little bit of lens of hope forward. So we appreciate what you're doing out there.
Yes. Thank you, Miranda.
Thank you. And you all are promoting the same kind of active, engaged hope in the work that you do here on this green earth. So I really appreciate being part of your project. Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, thank you.
We're grateful to have you on the show, and we hope to catch up with you soon. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, and I think we have just a couple minutes, and I wanted to bring up something that I saw the other day about the Nature Conservancy's fellowship programs.
Ah.
We have had them on this program before.
Sure.
And they have this Utah Nature Program Fellowship specific to our state, and it's a one-year position that starts January 1st, 2025, and ends December 31st, 2025. And the applications are coming due on November 14th, so I know that's only a couple days off,
okay.
But if you've been thinking about doing something like this, I think it lays the perfect foundation for people who are thinking about getting involved in conservation. And when you're young like that, you can look up to a mentor and you can absorb things from them and then see if it's a path that you want to follow. And I think more so now than ever, conservation is important. And so candidates can apply. All they have to do is go to actually the Nature Conservancy. If you look them up and then look up the Utah Nature Program Fellowship, you can apply there. And again, applications are due November 14th. And it's a great pathway for young people.
If you're interested in pursuing a career in the environmental field, what better mentor writ large than the Nature Conservancy.
Absolutely. And there are different fellowships that you can apply for as well. This one is specific to Utah. But if you want to check out others, you can go to climatefellowships.com to learn more.
I'll have to check that out.
Absolutely. Are you going to become an intern
I'm
somewhere?
I'm thinking about it.
Great. Me too.
It's never too late.
It's never.
To keep learning.
Honestly, it isn't ever too late. I would welcome that. So yeah, that's
right.
Something that you can do. Again, climatefellowships.com. This one in specifically is for the Nature Conservancy. It's the Utah Nature Program Fellowship. All right.
Hey, it's time to wrap up.
That's true.
Well, let's first thank our guest this morning. Our first guest was Farris Jaber, and he was talking about his new book, Becoming Earth, How Our Planet Came to Life. And it was a really interesting conversation. One thing I wanted to ask him was if the planet can be considered kind of alive, perhaps it kind of, maybe it could have some form of protection. Maybe we can consider it an endangered species.
Interesting,
and therefore
Chris.
It could get some protection as an endangered species, much like plants and insects and other things. Well, if the plant is a kind of a living organism per se, maybe there has some legal rights.
Well, we put together all of these, I think, protections of parts and pieces of it, but you're right, it isn't the
overall,
Earth as a whole.
It's certainly an endangered species.
Absolutely. That's an interesting question. I would have loved to hear his answer to that.
But we'll have to have Ferris back.
I know we're going to have Ferris back because the man is just an encyclopedia of information about the Earth, and he has written so many different articles for The New Yorker,
right.
The New York Times, Atlantic,
and books.
And so I think the man will be back on our show to talk more about all of his writings and the information that he has about the Earth. And also, we want to thank Miranda Massey, the director of the Climate Museum, who also founded it. The Climate Museum is located in New York City, and it is traveling about, and who knows, someday it might be here in Park City as well. And I love the idea of marrying art with these complex issues that we're dealing with climate. I think it gives people a better way of absorbing it. There's
get
a connection there.
Right.
Get engaged with, yes.
Right. And if communities have art museums and science museums and others, well, maybe these more and more communities need their own climate museum,
mm-hmm.
because climate change's impacts are felt differently in different parts of the country,
right.
and they can be localized like that. So that museum, climate museum in New York City, can be used as a template for climate museums elsewhere around the country.
Absolutely. I think they're just getting started. They're going to take off. Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review, and we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars. And you know, we love it when you email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for topics for further stories in the future you'd like us to cover. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.